Hello everyone, Rob here. Before we get to the episode today featuring Professor Samantha J. Simon from University of Arizona on her book about police academy training, I wanted to talk to you about an important and solemn event that's going to be taking place in Wilmington on the 15th of May next week, NACPA Remembrance Day. Here to help me do that is our old friend Mike Abel from Delawareans for Palestinian Human Rights and Dr. George Zahr. Hello. Thank you guys for joining.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There are two things that cemented my Palestinian liberation philosophy as a cause of mine politically. One was witnessing apartheid fall in South Africa as it happened. And the second one was the first time I read a historical account of the Nakba. So I just want to give some lead-up information before we get to that. So this is a brief history. I'm going to go high level. I'll mention some stuff for further reading, but it's just a general overview. I don't want a lot of historians picking this apart too much, but we can talk about it afterwards. Zionism emerged in the late 19th century as a secular intellectual philosophy cultivated in Western Europe and the United States. See also Theodor Herzl. This was a, to me, a rational outgrowth of the history of pogroms against the Jewish people in Europe before, during, and after this. The British government endorsed this philosophy after World War I in British-mandated Palestine. The biggest impetus here was anti-Semitism and not wanting Jewish immigration into Great Britain. See also Lords Balfour, Rothschild, et al. The early British policy was rather conservative regarding full settler colonization. And in about 1920, a more radical Zionism emerged called Revisionist Zionism. See also Ziev Jabotinsky, who wrote this in an essay called The Iron Wall in 1923. Zionist colonization must either stop or else proceed regardless of the native population, which means that it can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population, behind an iron wall, which the native population cannot breach. Meanwhile, Zionist emigration began to increase ahead of World War II, and the revisionist Zionists were mobilizing and training armed militia. The Palestinian people did revolt in the late 1930s, but their nationalist program was unorganized, and the rebellion was put down by the Brits and these militia. After World War II, a commission was convened by the U.S. and Britain called the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry to determine what to do with the poor souls liberated from the Nazi camps. About 100,000 of these refugees were Jews, and neither Britain nor Truman administration were keen on accepting these refugees because they were racist anti-Semites, basically. The acclaimed British-Lebanese historian Albert Hourani gave testimony to this committee in 1945, and this is what he said. In the past few years, responsible Zionists have talked seriously about the evacuation of the Arab population, or part of it, to other parts of the Arab world. The implementation of the Zionist program would involve a terrible injustice and could only be carried out at the expense of dreadful repressions and disorders, with the risk of bringing down in ruins the whole political structure of the Middle East. Dr. Zahr, can you speak about your family's experience with the catastrophe and what followed it?
Yes. Maybe the best way to start is with my father. My father is from the city of Nazareth, born in the city of Nazareth, and in the late 30s, moved to work in Jaffa. In 1940, he volunteered to join the British Army to go fight the Nazis in Europe. He was among 12,000 Palestinians who volunteered in the British Army to go fight the Nazis in Europe. And unfortunate for those guys were really, they were the disposable soldiers. They were put on the front lines. I know my father had 3 bullet holes in his body. And when we were kids, we would stick our fingers in one in his leg. So in 1946, came back to Palestine after his service in the British Army, got married. I was born in March 1948. My mother was at the time a French teacher in a nun's school, and my father was a housing builder. In 1948, I was born in March 9th. At a month old, my parents were forced out of their home in Jaffa into 90 miles away in the Jordanian desert. Basically, their life was turned, not upside down, but was turned off in a way. They spent their early nights with a one-month-old baby in the caves in Amman, where Bedouins usually stay in the tents and put their animals in the cave. So they stayed with the animals in the cave for the first few days to start a new life from zero in Amman, Jordan. And so I grew up in refugee camps. It's called Mahatta Refugee Camp. It was one of the oldest. Mahatta means station. It was next to the train station. And I went to UNRWA schools. Lucky for me, I was good in school. And I ended up having opportunities coming my way that I didn't know existed. So at age 28, I was able to get a PhD in theoretical chemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. And that's where I met my wife. My wife's family were among the Palestinians who didn't become refugees. She was born later in 54, and then in 64, her family immigrated to the United States. She was a student at Berkeley. I met her, and we got married. And I ended up spending 35 years working for a major American corporation. And I can say, don't feel sorry for me. I own $1 million home and a $100,000 car. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I think it's important to note that being driven out of a big city across a river into the Jordanian desert was, you wouldn't remember it, but I wonder how your parents described it. Was it the tip of a gun?
Well, it was. I've been asked this question a few times, but let me first. If you look at the numbers, the city of Jaffa, almost 98% of the people were forced out into refugee camps. Now, when there is a war, it is not unusual for people to run towards a safe place away from the fighting. So what it is that caused my parents to leave their house and end up in a cave in the desert must be something very horrible and scary. Normal people don't do that. But even the bigger crime is when the war is over, they were not allowed to go back to their homes. And 98% of the people of Jaffa ended up refugees in Amman.
Yeah, I think the total number... it is a huge number. As you said, your wife and her family were able to then just emigrate out without becoming refugees. But about 725 to 750,000 people in Palestine were, and it was more than half. I think it was might have been 75 to 80%
of the areas that Israel occupied in 67. They continued the process of ethnic cleansing till the late 50s, and they removed about 80% of the Palestinians. And the other 20% that stays is simply because they couldn't get to them. Fortunate enough, those other 20%, which were about 170,000 in 1948, are now 2.3 million. then these are the Israeli citizens, the Palestinian Israeli citizens.
So next week, on the Nakba Remembrance Day, we are going to go to an event that's being planned in partnership with many groups by Mike and her group, the Delawareans for Palestinian Human Rights. Can you give us some information on where it's going to be, what time? And I also want you to mention, because you mentioned it to me, and I think it's so important, this is going to be outside of Biden campaign headquarters. However, this action is a solemn vigil, right? So everybody feels that, like everybody gets that vibe. So let's go into it based on the history we just talked about, and as a real remembrance and a real reflection upon what we now know, what George has just taught you. So Mike, go ahead.
Sure. So Delawareans or Palestinian Human Rights and other local groups are holding a peaceful vigil. The date is Wednesday, May the 15th at 6:30 p.m. And it is in the H.B. DuPont Park, which is across from the Biden's headquarters. So as you know, George explained the history of the Nakba. We want to commemorate the Nakba. And we also want to be able to gather to express our grief on the human tragedy in Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and to demand an end to the genocide in Gaza and, you know, the occupation of Palestine. And I would like to add that the youth movement and the student movement are doing just incredible, amazing work. And all of these groups are acting in their own way as to what they want to do for humanity, for Palestine. And with all of these actions going on, Delfer Group and other groups just felt strongly that we needed to create a sacred space for people to grieve. We as activists have been so busy day to day on the cell phones, on the computers, action alerts. Things change every minute in Israel and Gaza and the West Bank. And we act, and we are not giving ourselves the time for pause and reflection. And this is what this is. So it is a vigil. We have speakers. There will be poetry. There will be, healthcare workers that are going to give stories about the healthcare workers in Gaza and the many healthcare workers, you know, that have died. So again, this is a public way to display this tragedy, and to do it in front of the Biden headquarters is a message. But our messaging is very, very peaceful, and it's giving people space to mourn.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Yeah, this is, if people are aware of outside the Brandywine building, this will be Wednesday evening, the 15th. The 15th is Wednesday, right? So if you're listening to this the day it comes out, next Wednesday, it's that park that's right in the middle of, like, the post office and the Y outside the Brandywine building. Everybody would be very familiar. I can also tell you that there is a monument there, I always thought it was funny, to the FDR's Four Freedoms in H.B. DuPont Park. I always thought that contradiction always, like, made me excited about that place. So I'm excited to go and join you. So I will be there, and I hope you'll all join us there. Dr. Zarr, are you going to be joining us as well?
Yes, I am going to be there. And let me just add one short comment. The Nakba is not just an event that happened in 48. It was a continuous event till these days, as we see in Gaza. Yes. At different points, different parts in different communities, etc., etc. So Palestinians will not forget, not just because it's an old event. It's an event that have impacted every generation of Palestinians since 1948.
Absolutely well put. And I'm glad I'll be able to see you again in person, and I'll see you all in person next week. So thanks a lot. We'll get on with the regularly scheduled program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks. You may have heard of this one. This is a this is a little story on the East Coast, and there's a little more to it. This came out in December of last year, so it's been almost 6 months. This is in NorthJersey.com. New Jersey comptroller says hundreds of cops attended training that, quote, undermined key reforms. Katie Sabko. An investigation by the Office of the State Comptroller found that hundreds of law enforcement officers from across New Jersey attended a private police training conference that taught unconstitutional police tactics, glorified violence, denigrated women and minorities, and likely violated a myriad of state laws and policies. A six-day training conference in October 2021, hosted by the New Jersey-based Street Cop Training, an independent police training consultancy, drew more than 240 officers from New Jersey. A majority of those officers were paid with public funds to attend the sessions, says a report released Tuesday by the Comptroller's Office. Private sessions like those provided by Street Cop Training are not under the authority of the State Attorney General's Police Training Commission or any other public entity and are not regulated. After reviewing hours of video footage and internal documents, as well as conducting witness interviews, the Comptroller's Office found that a lack of oversight allowed for deficiencies in the training. Records show that Street Cop Training had 240 New Jersey officers attend, and they came from 77 municipal police departments, 6 county agencies, 1 interstate agency, and 4 state agencies, including the New Jersey State Police, officials said. The Comptroller's Office independently confirmed that 3 county agencies, 48 municipal police departments, and 1 interstate agency, as well as 2 state agencies, including the police, spent money at this conference. The report alleges that more than 100 discriminatory and harassing comments were made, with speakers discussing the size of their genitals, displaying lewd images, and making demeaning quips about women and minorities. The report also alleges that instructors, including some active New Jersey police officers, advocated stopping motorists for no reason or illegally prolonging stops, which could violate people's civil rights and be unconstitutional under both federal and New Jersey laws. It says some instructors promoted, quote, a warrior approach to policing and dehumanized civilians, referring to them as pieces of shit in society or using offensive memes. Yeah, I don't know if you'd heard that story. I think that the guy who runs that, I think, has filed bankruptcy, and it's in litigation now, back and forth. But it was some pretty nasty stuff. There's videos online as well.
Yeah, I've certainly heard of that story, and there are, you know, several other stories that investigative reporters have written about training in general. Yeah. But a newer project that I've worked on, I've done some ethnographic field work at some of those private organizations that provide training to different police departments across the country.
Oh boy.
And there really is very little oversight on the curriculum and also the content in real time, anyway, the way that instructors talk about the curriculum in the actual classes. And the content can range quite substantially, and the tone of the interviewers trainers, and the opinions of the trainers certainly get, you know, are inserted throughout the training curriculum.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, hello everyone, friends and comrades. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. I'm Rob. Carl is out on assignment this evening, but our guest tonight is someone I'm excited to talk to. It's Professor Samantha Simon from the University of Arizona. She's written a new book. I always do this, and even though we're not on video, Before the Badge. How Academy Training Shapes Police Violence. Professor Simon, thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I want to first start with, like, the little background you give about how you came to do this. project because, you know, all kinds of police training and academy training is and everything about the police usually is especially secret. But you were given really unique access to do proper field work. And I just want you to take some time to explain the methodology and how you were able to do that.
Yeah, I started this project, or like most projects, this study really was conceived out of another study. So I was in graduate school at the time in Texas and took a class from a professor there named Harel Shapira, who does research on gun ownership, so civilian gun ownership. And he needed a research assistant on the project, and I was really interested in what he was doing. So I started doing ethnographic fieldwork with him. When I reference ethnographic fieldwork, essentially I'm referring to a research method that anthropologists use, sociologists use, other types of scholars use, where you get as close to the social phenomena that you're interested in studying. So you participate as much as you can, observe as much as you can. So this project, this other project I'm referencing, me and Dr. Shapira did ethnographic fieldwork, participating, observing in civilian gun training. And this was, you know, around in the state of Texas. I joined a women's shooting group, a club. We attended, at the time you needed a license to carry a gun, so we attended license to carry classes. And what I noticed when I was doing that fieldwork with Dr. Shapira was that a lot of the instructors for these civilian gun training classes or tactical training were themselves police officers, or they were retired police officers doing this as sort of a side gig during retirement. And in those interviews, I was asking them a lot of questions about the training that they were, you know, providing to civilians about how to think about violence, how to use violence, how to justify it in certain contexts. And, you know, sort of naturally started wondering how the training that they were providing civilians may be different or similar to the training that they themselves received as police officers, and in many cases were providing, you know, new officers in the academy setting. So, you know, then it was 2018 when I decided to pursue this project on police academy training. This was, you know, just a few years after Michael Brown had been killed, the Ferguson uprisings had happened. So policing was very, you know, top of mind for me as a sociologist and to the general public. So I knew that if I wanted to understand how these patterns and violence were persisting in policing more broadly, that I needed to look to the organization itself. And coming from that other project, knew that training was a very important component of these organizational processes.
Yeah, so you're given access to academy training at four sort of unnamed departments of different cities in the South. I guess they were different sized cities as well, some moderate, some larger, just to give a taste of sort of what kind of departments are doing this kind of training. But it was all within the same state, and it would all have been governed by one state sort of certification agency. Is that so?
Yes, that's correct. So most states have an organization that approves curriculums for academies, determines hiring requirements, things like that, called POST. It's an acronym, Peace Officer Standards and Training. So most states have one of those. The state did have that. So in that way, these departments had some things in common, certainly. And I outlined some of those commonalities in the book. The state mandated around 600 hours at the time of specified approved hiring in order to be a licensed police officer. Most municipal departments have additional training on top of that 600 hours. And the departments that are included in the study were that way. They had additional many, many hours, hundreds of hours of additional training. And you know, they have some leeway, some authority certainly in determining what that training is. Again, it's approved by POST. The curriculums have to be approved by POST. But yeah, so they had that in common. Those 600 hours were certainly in common. But like you said, the cities ranged in sizes. They ranged in demographic composition. And as a result, the, you know, individual police departments ranged in demographic composition. The political leanings of the cities varied. The sort of general sentiment of public support for the respective police departments varied. And I did that on purpose. I wanted to introduce some variation, some, you know, similarities in terms of being in the same state, having the same requirements, but some variation in the hopes that perhaps that would mean that the training looked different and I might be able to uncover better or worse ways to train new officers.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to note that you know, all the descriptions of cadets, of officers, of everyone is anonymized. You do do a fun job of sort of describing some of the main characters, which is a little fun. Maybe we'll get into that. But you were able to go into this sort of with a full academic approach. And the other thing I wanted to point out before we get into it is that, you know, this is a critique and an examination of a process anyway. One of my biggest influences was the late Michael Brooks. One of the axioms he would always use is be kind with people, but ruthless with systems. And this is a look at a system. It's not about particular people or kinds of people. And you also go to ends to make that point as well, because I think it's an important point to make.
No, I definitely agree. And when I'm training graduate students, for example, I often give them the advice that you cannot do a project if you hate the people that you're studying. And I really think that there is no benefit to dehumanizing anyone who's involved in your research or as a research participant. So again, like you mentioned, my goal in this was to humanize the people. I liked a lot of these people, you know, that I was hanging out with for hundreds of hours. I enjoyed the time that I spent with them. I, at the same time, however, as you mentioned, am pretty, you know, strongly critical of the institution and a lot of these organizational processes that happen. So I think you can, to some degree, strike a balance there, though it is difficult, I think, often for scholars.
Yeah. So you describe this process sort of in a succinct way as the socialization of state violence. Can you sort of broadly explain that concept, and then we kind of drill down into some of the specifics to sort of feed around that and what also some of the consequences are of that?
Yeah, of course. So in the book, I've organized the book chronologically. So I start with a chapter where I talk about the hiring process and discuss some of what hiring officers are looking for when they say they're looking for people who will be good officers. What does that actually look for? And then what are some of the hiring practices that test for that kind of fit? And then I bring my readers into the actual academy space, and I describe the different ideological and also physical transformations that cadets have to undergo in order to make it to graduation. And the last substantive chapter, I talk about the sorting process, is kind of how I describe it. So who doesn't make it to graduation? Why do they not make it to graduation? And what can that tell us about this organization and what its priorities are? So in the book, I introduced the concept of the socialization of state violence, as you mentioned. And the way that I define this or think about this is sort of a set of processes or practices at the organizational level that I argue ensure that those who make it into the institution and then to graduation and out onto patrol are willing to, at minimum, and at most actually eager to engage in violence.
Yeah, I think there's ways, and I was sort of fascinated by the ways that the intake is done, to weed out, obviously, the, you know, people who just aren't fit for it, but to also find people that are going to be more apt to, you know, to do what you tell them, more apt not to question the use of violence when needed or be eager to do it, or to also just accept sort of euphemisms. And one of the ones I wanted to bring up was sort of race. You said, you know, this happened right after the Ferguson uprising. We go on to the George Floyd sort of situation, and there's many, many things we can talk about. And of course, they're trying at the intake to weed out sort of like openly racist people or people who might even sort of hold those views even lately. So they're looking to weed those people out, but when they get into training, they're taught a whole new sort of set of things to do that are basically a proxy for that, and they just use sort of euphemisms and stuff. And you kind of have to buy into that stuff. When you saw this sort of manifesting and this sort of education being done, and this is mostly classroom stuff too. What did you make of that? How was that? How did they train that?
Yeah, I thought it was my first impression of some of this training. So just to clarify kind of what you're referencing, in the book, what I talk about is that formally, academy trainers tell cadets that in no situation should they racially profile. So they say this over and over again. Sometimes they even make it sort of a call and response. Do we racially profile? No, right? But they encourage cadets really strongly encourage cadets to profile what they call criminality. And then they use very thinly veiled language to describe criminality in ways that are deeply racialized. So they talk about part of the city, types of cars, types of clothing, gait, the way that they're walking, the way that they're holding themselves, all to indicate different kinds of, you know, racialized systems that we have that organize our social world. So that's sort of what you're referencing. And when I started the fieldwork and, you know, was in these academy spaces, it was really striking to me that officers will talk about race in a in an explicit way that most people, most white people, at least in the United States, are not comfortable doing. So they describe people in terms of their gender and race and age and physical embodiment all the time when they're writing up, you know, be on the lookout, or when they're writing up arrest reports, different sorts of documents like that. I mean, they're literally writing like black male, 42, white female, 32, you know, blue jacket, whatever. They're describing people in terms of their physical embodiments in ways that, you know, we've categorized people. But at the same time, they wouldn't say it. They wouldn't say what they meant when they were talking about profiling. They would use, again, this very coded language. And, you know, in one instance that I describe in the book at Terryville Police Department, again, as you mentioned, these are all pseudonyms, but I call it Terryville. One of the instructors essentially says, you know, we do not racially profile because that's discrimination. We don't do that. But if you pull someone over because, or if you profile someone because you think they're a burglar, like that's just good police work. You should be able to profile someone who's engaging in criminal activity. You should be able to profile someone who wants to hurt or kill you. Again, though, they then use these very racialized concepts to determine who is engaged in criminal activity and who isn't. So I was struck by that, you know, contrast of the way that race was treated in these spaces.
Yeah, you mentioned another thing that I think is an important concept that you sort of map out, you know, across the whole process, is this transformation into a mindset where the police themselves are in sort of a hermetically sealed bubble. And then outside of them are either people who are criminals and violent people who could potentially kill them at any time, or people who needed their protection. So it was like the warrior sort of protector dichotomy. And it was interesting to me, because the other thing that's mentioned by police throughout the book and in some of your interviews is that other people don't understand inside the bubble. But the way that they're looking at the people that they're serving and policing is pretty strange, I think. But you think explain that through this process very well, how they go about sort of developing that dichotomy with them.
Yeah. I mean, they do a very, essentially when cadets enter the academy, what I describe in the book is these different sets of others that they learn are oppositional to them, or, you know, at its height, an actual threat, either institutionally or, you know, a physical threat, presents a physical threat to them. So I outline some of these others who present threats to policing more generally, sort of the institution, but also individual police officers. So I talk about activists. At the time, of course, activists mostly meant Black Lives Matter. Again, this was 2018. But there were also instances where trainers would show videos or talk about like the Occupy movement, sort of disparagingly. They showed one video, for example, of officers spraying tear gas or OC spray, I can't remember exactly what it was, on a crowd of protesters at an Occupy protest, and they described it as, you know, watering the hippies.
It's a great reference, great mid-20th century reference.
Sure, yeah. So it wasn't just Black Lives Matter activists, but that was certainly their focus at the time in 2018. Other sorts of opposition or threats, they would really emphasize all the time that there was a war on cops happening, that policing, even if they didn't use that phrasing, they would talk about policing as being more dangerous than it had ever been for officers, that there were folks out there, very much wanting to hurt and kill them, hunting police officers, sometimes the verb that they would use, to ambush them. And they would use examples from across the country. And again, this does happen sometimes. Ambushes do happen, and they are tragic when they happen. I don't condone murder of any kind. However, the narrative that it was getting worse, that this violence was intensifying, that officers were in more danger than they ever had been, there's really just no empirical support to sustain those claims that this is a trend over time. So, you know, they would talk about these bad guys as being around any corner, that sort of, as you referenced, it was very important that cadets remain hypervigilant at all times about these threats. Sometimes this was communicated verbally as verbal warnings, and often it was communicated through showing video footage of officers being, you know, beaten or killed while on duty. And again, this is real footage. This is not, you know, doctored footage in any way. But for example, in every academy that I visited multiple times at each academy, the cadets were shown a video of Deputy Kyle Dinkeller, who was murdered in 1998, I believe in Georgia. And this became this, you know, omnipresent prolific video that cadets across the country are shown. There's a New York Times article about this video and about Kyle's father, who still travels around the country talking to cadets about officer safety and vigilance. And the video is horrifying. I mean, I would physically become nauseous when they would show this video. I mean, it's really a horrifying video.
You describe it in the book a little bit, and it sounds very bad.
Yeah. I mean, you can hear him dying. Yeah. You can hear the audio of him dying. And so it's a traumatic video to watch. Cadets were shown it over and over again to really hammer home the point that this could be their fate. If they did not adopt this warrior mentality, if they did not prioritize officer safety over anything, then they could die like this man did in 1998. They would also do different exercises. You know, you might remember in the book I talk about at Hudson PD, the cadets were required, if during a tactical exam that they were required to complete, if they lost their weapon, it was a fake firearm, of course, but it was a rubber pistol. If they lost that, if it was taken from them during the course of this grappling session, so a fight essentially with one of their trainers, they were required that night to write their own obituary, outlining who they were leaving behind, their partner, you know, who they were on patrol with, their family members. So these were really quite visceral experiences, activities, exercises, rituals that cadets were required to do, again, which really heightened their sense of danger and their sense of opposition to the public.
Yeah, I juxtapose that against some of the other conversations that you report in the book about officers, trainers, basically saying, well, you know, there are some bad ones. There are some mistakes. I think several officers might have said this about George Floyd specifically, but pretty much hadn't happened yet. Was it which one did they? Maybe it was the guy in South. Okay. I knew there was one that they kept pointing to be like, well, that one's bad. But in a similar fashion to the way they sort of see police violence against them, they dismiss, you know, just other sort of all of these other incidents, which I found like a very interesting way to sort of flip those around for people. I wanted to ask about one other aspect before sort of the big final question to get your thoughts about is, I mentioned before I've advocated for different things, and now I'm actually working pretty much full time on police reform and sort of advocacy and activism in the community around it. And I'm working within the public defender's office. And when we talk about sort of like what we can do, training comes in quite a bit. We have our own post. They actually just changed it from what used to be called COPT to POST. That was the big reform, is the name changed. But talking about, body cameras or training, if we train the body cameras or we de-escalate, you go into, and I want to talk about this word de-escalation because it's used as a colloquialism in sort of discussions, but it doesn't really come up in the training that much. And when it does, it doesn't come up the way you would think. So I'd like to just to talk about this idea of de-escalation and how it's discussed inside the academies.
Yeah. So again, this was 2018. So at the time, And again, this wasn't that long ago, but you know, it's been a few years. So I don't know what it looks, what de-escalation training looks like now. It's possible it looks different. I wouldn't predict that it looks that much different from what I saw. But at the time, this state that I studied, or that in which I was studying these academies, didn't require de-escalation training. So this was not part of those 600 mandated hours. These municipalities, these municipal departments had decided to add de-escalation training into their curriculums. It was just 4 to 8 hours, depending on the academy, among the four academies that I studied. So it was very short in comparison to, you know, their tactical training, for example, which is usually close to 200 hours, depending on the academy. So it was very, very short on the training. And what I generally heard from officers, the sentiment that I heard from officers was that de-escalation was a buzzword. One officer made a joke that perhaps a sociologist had come up with the word. I'm a sociologist, so gotcha. He's poking fun at me. That it didn't describe or characterize anything new for policing, that they had always been de-escalating, that they had always taken on strategies to de-escalate situations and prevent them from becoming physical. And thus, this was just a buzzword, but you know what, if we have to call it something else to sort of appease the public, then we'll do that. And in the de-escalation training, again, which was just 4 to 8 hours, and the name of the class varied by department. At several departments before it changed into de-escalation training, there was sort of a rebranding, like you just referenced, from verbal judo into de-escalation training or tactical communications or some sort of name like that. But really the sentiment here, what was trained or told to cadets, was that de-escalation represented the idea that you should approach a situation politely. You know, when you first engage in contact, that first contact that you make with someone for a call for service or on the street or a proactive stop, you should be polite. You should be even-toned. There's no reason, unless officer safety calls for it, that you should go in super hot, unless you need to. And there's always that caveat. So that's really what de-escalation meant. But throughout the class, they repeatedly urged cadets that they should not prioritize officers, or I'm sorry, should not prioritize de-escalation over officer safety in any situation. And when you look at de-escalation policies, for example, that some departments have, you know, integrated into their general, you know, rules and policies, you'll usually see at the end of the policy, there'll be some sort of clause that essentially says everything above goes out the window if officer safety is threatened. So officer safety is always the number one priority. In these de-escalation classes, for example, one instructor, and I quote it in the book, but said something to the effect of, you know, don't make me go to your funeral. Don't make me go to an officer funeral because you were using your words when you shouldn't have. They also, again, showed that video that I described earlier of Deputy Dinkheller being killed in the de-escalation class. Again, to emphasize that if you de-escalate, if you choose to de-escalate when you shouldn't be, when you should have been going hands-on, if you prioritize that over, you know, the sense of officer safety, then you, like Deputy Dinkheller, could be brutally murdered.
Yeah, it is. I like the way that you present it, and I like the way that you tell it, because you can hear it in a regular neutral sort of tone, and it still sounds insane. But you know, it is interesting the way that, and I think that's the trick, right? Is that we can tell you this other stuff, but really we're going to tell you that officer safety trumps everything. If anything happens, if you make a mistake in training, you have to write your own obituary. I'm going to scare you into, you know, going to these funerals. And also, there was another thing you mentioned, and I don't remember the exact details, so maybe you could remind me. At some point during tactical training, at somewhere, or maybe this happened across different places, you know, the punishment for using excessive force, and you're like, oh, you just shot a mom or something, that was one thing. But the punishment for using not enough force and getting bang bang, you know, you're dead killed was far worse. So the mistake of using less was a worse mistake, or punished worse than kind of, you know, just shooting a mom with a stroller or something. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but there was there was an imbalance of sort of priorities there.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And the what I describe in the book is that, of course, and maybe this doesn't go without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, that these instructors are certainly not telling cadets to go around shooting unarmed civilians. That is not something that they're saying to cadets. They're not encouraging cadets to go kill people. That's not what's happening. It's certainly not explicit in that way. What is happening, though, and what you're describing, is that there are two different mistakes that can happen, right? You can either make the mistake to assume someone is armed when they're not, or the opposite. And the instructors are very clear that if you're going to make one of those two mistakes, you ought to make the one where you walk away from it. So you assume that they're armed when they're not. And the way that law is written, the way that Graham v. Connor has established legal precedent, is that that's true legally. The officer simply has to perceive a threat and then articulate that they perceived a threat to their life, and generally they're good to go. But yeah, I use one example to really illustrate this point, where at Rollingwood, you know, in one instance, cadets were split up into two groups and they were told to search one another. And one cadet and each partner was told to make furtive movements. So meaning put your hands in your pocket, kind of try to walk away, avoid eye contact, all things that officers, you know, believe to mean that someone is lying, that they are committing a crime, or that they could potentially be armed. And then the other officer is supposed to, or sorry, the other cadet who's playing the officer is supposed to be in tune with that, notice these furtive movements, disarm the person, and then put them in cuffs. They don't know that some of their partners, some of these partners who are playing the civilian, don't have a weapon. They just have a miscellaneous object. So in one pair of cadets, for example, one of the cadet playing the civilian pulls out a Sharpie from their pocket, and their partner shoots them immediately. In another pair of cadets, the cadet playing the civilian pulls out it's a fake yellow crack pipe, and their partner shoots them immediately. So these furtive movements are happening. They're keyed in on that. They've just been trained for a week to expect that if someone avoids eye contact, that they might be armed. And then they're presented with the situation. And, you know, in many cases, these cadets make that mistake. They shoot someone who actually was unarmed. The instructors are not visibly angry. They're not, you know, upset with the cadets. The cadets are not punished in any way physically. Whereas when they don't use enough force, or they don't use deadly force when the instructors believe that they should because their life was threatened, and this happens during their tactical final, where they have to grapple one of their instructors, which is, you know, using Brazilian jiu-jitsu to try and maintain physical control over their instructor. Their instructor takes their, you know, rubber pistol, throws it across the ring. A few of the cadets go pick up the pistol and reholster and re-engage in the fight. That is not what the instructors wanted them to do. They wanted them to shoot the instructor, since they just had their gun taken from them. And in that case, the instructors were enraged. And I really don't use that word lightly. They were enraged. They were cursing. They were shouting. They were yelling. And they required the cadets to do all kinds of physical tasks, push-ups, squats, running, as punishment for not using enough force. So even if instructors, my point here is that even if instructors are not telling cadets, go shoot unarmed civilians, and they're not saying that, these training exercises, this organizational socialization process is really instilling that lesson physically into the cadets.
So this is the big sort of conclusion, and I don't want to misrepresent sort of your conclusion. You know, I think you say something like, in these books, you know, you're always expecting like a couple bullet points, and there really aren't any. But I do think you do make it fairly clear, at least to me, that the real issue isn't, you know, sort of reforms around the edges, but it's the entire concept of what we're doing. And so while sort of abolishment you know, not maybe it's impractical, but you're sort of arguing for a full sort of relook on the whole concept of what it is this is supposed to be doing. And I tend to agree with that. although I do work in police reform. My issue and I don't know whether you get this feeling or not, I certainly do, is that, you know, to be able to reform something or to make, you know, sort of, you know, administration or training changes or anything like that, you need a partner. And I don't, everything about this book and everything that I know, I don't think the police are a civic partner. They want to do what they want to do, and the public doesn't understand what that is. And so given that dynamic, I tend to agree with your sort of general conclusion. But again, I don't want to go too far in the weeds. I'd like you to explain your conclusion and then maybe comment on a little bit of that.
No, I think that's a pretty accurate description of a conclusion chapter. I mean, when I was writing this book, my editor was really pushing me to give something to the reader at the end, you know, something to maintain optimism or some sort of action item that we can kind of organize around that would maybe improve the situation. But the more that I've read over years and years and years now about the police, the more that I understand the history of policing in the United States and more broadly, just the history of the concept of contemporary policing, the more pessimistic I became about the potential for reform. I mean, you know, I outlined this in the conclusion chapter, but when you go back and look at commission reports, up to almost 100 years ago. I mean, there's one in 31, one in 67, one in 2015. Each of these commissions were convened by a president who was concerned about some sort of, you know, high profile instance of or pattern in police brutality. You know, the concept of the third degree comes from one of these commission reports because there were forced confessions from, you know, torture that were happening by police officers in the 20s. And in each of these reports, the commission outlined some reform suggestions, some recommendations as to what might improve these situations. And it becomes almost eerie when you read these recommendations for reform that they're so similar over a century, where folks are advocating, you know, this commission is advocating or recommending at minimum that the training change, that the requirements for hire change, that we hire a more demographically diverse police force, that we abandon this warrior mindset, which isn't always called that, but is described in that way, for a more guardian approach to, or social service oriented or community policing oriented approach to policing. So we've been having actually the same conversation for almost 100 years with there have been changes in policing, but the problems are very similar and very persistent. So what I do at the end of the book is, and it may be unsatisfying to readers, unfortunately, or for better or for worse, is I introduce readers to abolitionist frameworks. I talk about that policing is certainly not an inevitability. We made it up. We made up this institution, and it is within our power, our capabilities as human beings, to think of a different solution to harm. Abolitionists are not utopian. They do not believe, you know, that, I mean, I'm speaking generally for abolitionists. There are many different perspectives that are represented in abolition in general, but they're generally not advocating that we get rid of policing and not replace it with anything else. They're generally advocating for investment in other types of community support that would make policing as it currently is obsolete, and that we instead replace it with different kinds of systems to address harm that are not so violent. So that's really what I introduce readers to at the end, though it is not a simple or, you know, concrete policy suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, it may not be satisfying to some, but it, again, I agree with the conclusion and the direction. You know, you mentioned it a few moments ago about, you know, how it's more dangerous to be a police officer. This is one of the things that, you know, kind of feeds into that mentality of being ready to kill anybody you meet. But it's not true, of course. But I think you bring that up in a few sort of interviews over the time. It's like, well, it's actually not. But if it doesn't really matter that it's not to this, then the whole process needs a big reevaluation. You know, if we can't talk about like just regular stuff, if your sort of officer, if your perception of your own safety, whatever that means, is a trigger to fatal violence, then, you know, we probably need a big rethink, I would say. You know, it seems like. And what your book, you know, taught me was that's what it is. I mean, the process is, we're getting out exactly what the process is meant to do. So whatever you think is wrong with it, it has our training is achieving its goal. That's sort of how I took it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, you know, it's achieving the institution's goal. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. It's as part of a establishment institution, as we said before, as part of a system that we're talking about. It's certainly achieving that goal. Yeah, for sure. Professor Simon, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. I enjoyed the book, and I will be circulating it amongst you know, the police reform cadre that I work with, and maybe I'll get them to buy some of their own copies too.
Perfect. Thank you for reading it, and yeah, thank you for the conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. We'll speak to you soon, everybody. Left is best.